And we are back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Fertel, and my human voice has grown back. So sorry about last week. And secondly, for the first time in a long time in the Crooked Studio, if you're watching us on YouTube, you can see this. They put me in the fancy studio with like the buttery Orville Redenbacher type lighting. I look so tan. It's like anybody looks tan in this room. Like Mary Poppins would look like tan in this room.
That's why they keep Lovett in there.
I know. Please. They save it for him. It's like his cryogenic chamber.
Yeah. Has you run into him since he's been back?
No, mysteriously. And as you know, we do push-ups side by side sometimes at the same place. I'm very much looking forward to like scaring him out of breaking the NDA. I will get him in prison. I will.
I have to imagine being on Survivor and then returning. Maybe you need a tiny break from a Barry's class, or maybe a Barry's class feels quaint.
Yeah, right.
To be honest.
Oh, yeah, you've seen everything now. Exactly. And like you've hidden idols in all parts of your body. So, you know, your morals and standards have changed.
So I'm right now on Fire Island, which always happens to both of us at a certain point during the summer. There's always one of us recording an episode from here.
Oh, yeah. No, that's my anthropological, like I'm in the trenches here in Fire Island doing Keep It for everybody. And then the Wi-Fi situation is always a major gamble, but you're actually doing well so far.
Yeah. It's weird when people notice you and then say that they like the podcast, like when you're out in the wild here, as if it's, I don't know, not a common place for gay people to come from New York. You know, it's like they've seen me in like Crete or something. Like, what are you doing here?
Right. No, well, Fire Island definitely has its own unmistakable vibe. Like the speed of Fire Island is like nowhere else on Earth. I may get there in the next couple of weeks or so. We'll see how my schedule works out, but
I do love how it feels like, you know, like Cabot Cove, like just a small town.
Yes.
You're just walking past people's houses.
Right. Except there's never a murder over there. And God, you know, I've prayed for some.
I would love a Fire Island murder mystery. Like, where's Knives Out there? Daniel Craig's character is gay, so.
Right. Oh, that's true. That would be a nice little sojourn for him. Now, I can picture you in full number one ladies detective agency gear solving that shit there. They're like, sir, it's not Botswana here.
Yeah. People do leave their doors open. It's very, you know,
yeah, there
small
is that
town.
Too. There's a very casual vibe. Like during the big party days, people wander in and out of homes and like you'll just like hear music playing. For instance, the new Ariana Grande, The Boy Is Mine video. And I bring her up because I cannot get that video of her doing an interview and her voice changes for a split second before she jumps back up into her twinkly Ariana Grande timbre. And I'm just thinking, is she on all the time? When Ariana Grande is talking to you, is she kind of doing a character, you know, like Pee Wee Herman or something?
Yeah. I don't know. The only time I've interacted with her was years ago when I was at MTV News and it was rehearsals for the VMAs. And my boss let me sit in on that rehearsal for her side by side performance. Nicki Minaj was not there. Of course, she landed like an hour or so before the VMAs. So
oh, yeah.
A dancer stood in for Nicki's part of it. So I haven't gotten to meet her. But Ariana, when interacting with the dancers and like interacting with the lighting person, was in her full like, hi. So, you know, I feel like if she's on all the time, maybe it's just become part of her persona at this point.
Okay. I mean, like, it's the Paris Hiltonification of a certain generation of people. There's just like, they choose a voice and stick with it. Though, you know what? That's kind of old Hollywood, too. Like, I think Grace Kelly made that mid-Atlantic accent up. Like, she was from Philadelphia, but also seemed to be from every European country.
Okay. That is also why I am very pro Austin Butler. I feel like he has taken the Elvis thing, but also sort of modulated it to a voice that's him. And when you see him doing red carpet interviews now, you see it somewhere. He was being interviewed by this woman and he was like, I don't want to, you know, answer all these boring questions, miss. Like, what, like, like, what are you into? You know, and like was asking her about her hobbies, and she was like, I think I have to do the interview now. My boss will be upset with me. But you know, like he's very much old Hollywood, it feels like.
Right. No, he always has a sort of high noon grit about him. And also kind of is acting like he's always giving the GQ interview of a lifetime, I think, too. Yeah. Like I can picture him posing in several photos within the Q&A.
Yeah, there's probably an old 1973 Playboy interview with Austin Butler that exists somehow.
I'm going to examine microfiche at the library and see if we can find this, detective style.
But it's interesting you brought up Ariana Grande too, because I want to say that I was low-key shocked that she dropped A Boy Is Mine video and did a sort of performance of it too, because we're in this pop star era where people sort of have released their albums and then it's bye, bitch.
It sure is. I haven't thought of that Dua Lipa album in weeks. I know you were a bigger fan of it than I am, but it came on recently, a song from it. I'm like, I actually had forgotten the title of this. I think it also has to do with like all these albums are for some reason or another clumped together right now. Like I feel like one week after another, we get an album. And in fact, this week we're talking about Normani's album.
Well, when you say bye, bitch, you really do think of Normani, because this woman announced her album in 2018 and then vanished for almost 6 years before she actually gave it to us.
And also when she announced she was giving us this album, it was like, I see you wrote a date, but I see you didn't write a year. Like, I don't know when it's going to be. Like, we all had our... Listening to it now, it feels like when people finally got that Chinese Democracy album by Guns N' Roses or something. Like, it always felt more in theory than an actual recorded piece of media.
Fortunately for us, this album is actually the opposite of Chinese Democracy.
It sure
and quality.
Is. We'll get into it, but very enjoyable.
Yeah, and also, the Tony Awards happens.
Yes, and as you know, Ira has said on this podcast, I'm recalling it, this isn't supposed to be a gotcha. I'm not Nikki Fink, remember her? You said you enjoyed Eddie Redmayne in the Cabaret at the Kit Kat Club, this new version of Cabaret.
I did.
And you will get to justify that, because I was livid. Exciting moment for you. Hope you come through.
You know what? I will firmly defend Eddie Redmayne, okay?
All right.
With my life.
You're the good nurse for Eddie Redmayne, if you will. I actually liked him in that movie.
Also, we are joined by a truly marvelous talent this week. Lily Gladstone is here to talk about her new film, Fancy Dance.
Excuse me. This woman, she comes on the Zoom, and just the first words out of her mouth, like, I'm numbed, and the command she has, and it's so casual and so generous. Like, just the qualities I think everybody associates with her, they are just real. It was awesome to talk with her. And this movie is so good, too.
Yeah. And also was basically sort of, like, languishing, I feel like, until even recently, because post Killers of the Flower Moon, it was still looking for a distributor coming out of the Sundance lab. And now it's here. It's on Apple TV. So
you will enjoy her right along with us, I assure you.
Yeah. So we will be right back with more Keep It.
Crooked is going big because we refuse to go home. Help us hit our $100,000 fundraising goal in support of organizations fighting in states where conservatives are banning drag shows and trying to erase queer culture from public life. Can you imagine anything more sad and boring than a world without drag? Of course you can't.
So let's make gay while the sun shines. Donate directly to the fund or pick up items from our new Pride or Else collection and let Crooked do it for you, with a portion of proceeds going directly to the fund. Learn more at crooked.com/pride.
Make Gay While the Sun Shines sounds like a charity single you release, Marlo Thomas style.
The Tony Awards, otherwise known as the true start of Pride Month for theater gays, aired Sunday night. Unfortunately, Ariana DeBose did not rap while hosting. Also, she brought up the BAFTA rap one more time, though, and I think this is the last time we're allowed to mention that ever on television or in the context of her.
It's like saying Macbeth in a theater. I think we've done it. Yeah. And we know the ramifications thereof.
No. However, there were some surprising and some boring moments and some very weird moments within the Tonys. And honestly, I'm just glad it was a fun award show, to be honest.
I thought it was, for the Tonys, a bit underwhelming. And in that, I didn't feel like there were many performances that would get people to go out and see the shows. Which, not to say that they're bad shows. Like, I think the Outsiders did an amazing job. That performance was fabulous. And also, you know what's a really brilliant move? You have that performance on stage, which is, of course, an adaptation of the movie you're familiar with from the 80s with Matt Dillon, et cetera. And then you get to flash from time to time to Angelina Jolie in the audience. And then she is just spellbinding. I mean, just she really combines like both classic glamour and also insect-like intrigue. Like, I just look at her and I'm like, put it in a petri dish.
It's always nice when you hear like a story about a celebrity who is just sort of interesting and fun and normal. And I want to shout out for the Outsiders, my friend Juan Zay Johnson, who is part of the ensemble and therefore a Tony winner. He arrived in Fire Island yesterday to celebrate with us. And telling me just about hanging out with Angelina Jolie and how normal and cool she is.
Oh, which I'm sure you just hated to hear. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I was like, well, when am I going to meet this bitch? Because I have some things to talk to her about. A table condiment, if you will.
We don't even say the word anymore. We don't even say salt. Ma'am, you were in a certain table condiment film.
And what are we going to do about a sequel?
Yeah. I feel like it's not out of the realm of possibility. Okay, another thing I didn't know. Hell's Kitchen, a musical that is filled with the songs of Alicia Keys, is a jukebox musical. I thought she wrote new music for this.
There's some.
Yeah, there's some, but Fallen is a song in this show. And I just want to say once and for all that I fucking hate the song Fallen.
American Idol did it, didn't it?
It was American Idol auditions. When Fallen came on, you're like, here comes a bad time from somebody who, like, they didn't even get too much support in their high school theater program. They decided they were the star, is what the deal was. And, like, the version they did was kind of sped up. I wasn't in love with it.
Yeah, I mean, it is a jukebox musical. I think that's one thing they're sort of hiding. I don't know why. It's not like it would offend me. I felt like some people who've gone to see it have felt like either it's going to be entirely Alicia Keys songs or they're like, oh, she wrote new shit for it like you did. I enjoy the show. I mean, I think the performers sing down in the show. And I've always said, in the nicest way possible, Alicia Keys is a songwriter and great producer. And I just love hearing Broadway singers sing the songs.
The Arethification of this quote. Oh, my God. No, I mean, by the way, she's routinely a very good singer, but I see what you mean. Yes, yeah.
She is. I love Alicia Keys, to be honest. I've always been hooked on Alicia since Songs in A Minor, since Diary of Alicia Keys.
Yeah, I think that's her best album, that one.
Yeah, that one is just, I mean, there are certain Alicia Keys songs where I'm just like, that is it for me. I mean, Jane Doe, Woman's Worth, but I don't know. When you listen to her very distinct voice, I'm always a fan of jukebox musicals in general. If the quality of the song is good, as in like it's a well-written song that you would like to hear interpreted by other people, and then the people interpreting it are fucking amazing. You know, like, do I need to go see the new Huey Lewis and the News musical? I don't know.
You know what, though? I have to tell you, I was in the car recently and The Power of Love came on. And as you know, that's like the theme. It's the Oscar-nominated song from Back to the Future. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, get the cocaine in my nose when that song comes on. Holy shit, what a banger. Also, he sounds fucking amazing. Obviously, if you saw the We Are the World USA for Africa documentary, they kind of pull him out of the crowd of celebrities for a big solo moment, and he's the exact right name for that. Like, he comes through, his voice is so smoky, so rich. Also, he just seems like a really smart person in general. Also, Jimmy Kimmel, whom I work for, is obsessed with Huey Lewis, and he's just around sometimes. So I just see him.
Okay, always bringing the news.
Yeah, right. Also, what Jimmy told me about Huey Lewis in the News that I did not know, their albums for a while, like he has an album called Sports, and then there was a different album called Weather, It's because those are different sections of the news.
Okay. Shtick. I love that.
He committed more to his shtick than like Sufjan Stevens did. You know what I mean?
Wait, I mean, is there one called Traffic?
I would love one of the, called The Funny Papers or whatever. Yeah, no, I appreciate the effort. Now, we also need to talk about Ariana DeBose's opening song. First of all, the woman looks amazing, of course. But that song, yeah. What was it called? You're Here For You, or We're Here For You, or You Belong, or whatever. It was so giving, like CBS Network Showcase song. You know, where like they get all the stars ahead of the big season. Like, here's Felicia Rashad dancing about the new season of television. And so dorky. And I feel like it must be said, obviously people associate Broadway and Broadway people with a kind of dorkiness. I'm sorry. I think quote unquote cringe things are good for this generation. I need them to sit and watch things that make them squirm and think we're all a little dorkified and we're all being a little too vulnerable right now, because their ironic remove, I've had it with that. I'm done with that pose. I find it not that funny anymore. Just be cheesy and sit and watch a variety show. Go watch fucking like Carol Burnett sketches from the 70s and Carpenter specials, etc. I need you guys living in cringe.
Yeah, well, I think Gen Z is going to run out to watch the Carpenter specials. I think they'd be very interested in Karen Carpenter's story, to be honest.
That's true.
So you're right there. I love the idea of sort of cringe-worthy theater things. I mean, there's just something quote-unquote cringe-worthy about bursting in a song anyway,
right?
About loving musical theater genuinely, about, I don't know, me going to fucking Marie's Crisis in the middle of the week and singing along to show tunes with other people. Like, it doesn't seem necessarily cool, but I don't know, it's fucking fun. I did show tunes on Sunday in Fire Island, and it's just fun belting The Wizard and I with your friends.
Totally.
You know?
Also, a phrase that's coming back, or that at least my friend Jordan says all the time, queening out. We need some queening out these days. It makes me laugh every time I say it. Come on, queens.
We're the queens.
Yeah, right.
Where are the queens, okay? the queens are not going home on Drag Race, so we need everyone else to step up to the plate. I think I called that fucking season Jean-Paul Sartre's Drag Race.
People just like on stage, like stationary, not going anywhere. Yeah.
I truly have not paid attention to a single bit of Drag Race because I'm sorry. It's not a competition show if no one's going home.
And I feel like if nobody's going to go home, they better be the best of the best. And while these are talented queens, I enjoy them. It's just not quite the level of that other All-Stars where it was like the Alaskas and Jinx Monsoons, whatever, where it's like, I have to see what they do every week and it would be a crime to eliminate them. Like, these queens are still at the stage where an elimination would bring necessary drama.
And because no one's being eliminated, people are turning in there's been some abysmal performances that I did see. And it's, if you're not going to be critiqued, you're going home, then what are we even doing here?
Yeah, that's tough. That's tough. I do feel like there should have been critiques also at the Tonys.
Here we go.
Just a panel of people being like, not sure about that.
Eddie.
Let's start there. Okay, so as you know, Cabaret, let's talk about the musical film. Wonderful film. Liza Minnelli, perhaps the greatest Nepo Baby performance of all time. And you know I'm a Jane Fonda stan. It's crazy that I would admit that. You got your Joel Grey in the movie playing the MC who's twisted and, you know, a showman and then also downright evil. They play both sides of that to aplomb. In this version, and you'll have to explain this to me, I think what Eddie Redmayne is doing is evoking some sort of mime from like maybe France or something in like that time, like 20s, 30s, whatever. But also there's something about his performance which starts in extreme close-up, and I want to say they made an error right there starting with that. But in this performance, the way he moves in down to his facial expressions, it reminded me of an animatron and also a little bit of computer-generated graphics. And I feel like there's something uncanny valley about the way he was moving that I felt was unsettling. And maybe we're judging that as opposed to what the artistry of the performance in a way. But I just want to say I wanted to kill it with fire.
Okay, so you're saying he was giving Clippy, you know, yes. I see you're writing an essay.
Talk about a queen. Oh my God, here comes Clippy, and he has things to say about your document. Move this along, he says.
I think that the presentation of him did not really represent what I saw on stage. And
okay.
I will offer, the show is very much, it, you know, this whole Dust Bowl mime sort of like thing. And I don't like the full production because I feel like it sort of takes away from the entire show.
Yeah.
To be honest. But I think that because I feel like the show is swallowed up by like this whole concept that is happening within the Kit Kat Club of it all, I found Eddie at least alluring and interesting to watch on stage as opposed to the rest of the show just feeling very much not like cabaret at all.
Mm. Yeah, it feels more like an execution of like a concept that could belong to almost any other play, and they just associated it with, they decided to affix it to cabaret, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that British shit, you know, they love it over there.
Right.
But I think it's also, this is a thing that I learned in college, to be honest, when I was doing this production of Ionesco's Exit the King. And I had this concept that I was going to make it like The Young and the Restless. What I loved about The Young and the Restless is it was always about boardroom drama, you know? And so I had set this play about like a crumbling kingdom within sort of like an office. You know, I had this dumb like sort of like elevator thing opening up and like a bunch of extras just acting like people milling about the office. Which is all to say that Anne Shanahan, my teacher at the time, my professor, who maybe said that I was adding a little bit too much to the production and needed to learn how to edit, was right. In retrospect. And this is what this feels like, you know? It's sort of like, people always make the joke where, wouldn't it be interesting to see a Shakespeare play where it's set in the time that it's actually set in? Instead of like, here's Hamlet in 1942 Russia, you know?
Right.
And the Kit Kat Club just sort of feels like that. We're throwing this thing onto it that doesn't really serve the show, and there's too much busyness going on that takes away from it, because also the theater itself, they've built out the back of the stage so that they can add people like watching it. It's almost like it's in the round. I just think there's too many audience members. It's too big. You're playing to too much, and it just feels like the entire show, when you have the smaller moments, are swallowed up by the mess, which is just all to say that Eddie Redmayne being messy is one of the only parts of the show that's kind of enjoyable.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, I will say in general, when it comes to a play's take on material, especially if it's a revival or something, I think how I judge whether it's a success is, does it feel like an approach to the material or just a concept? Mm. And I feel like approach is like the angle that theater directors should take. Like, how are we honoring what's there and shaping it and illuminating it? Not like sort of doing this thing that stands along. Side it. Now, that said, to get back to fun, cringy things, Jonathan Groff and Daniel Radcliffe and Lindsay Mendez, the stars of the Merrily We Roll Along revival, their energy is, to me, what the Tonys are all about. There was a giddiness about the three of them that was, and first of all, there's obviously a sweetness towards Jonathan Groff, who had not won a Tony before and is just this mainstay on The Great White Way. Daniel Radcliffe, who, you know, has been on Broadway before and now has his big moment. There's just something about the three of them. Like, they should work together again. I hope this isn't the end for them.
I love that show so much. And seeing them on stage perform, it kind of evokes Singing in the Rain.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Good Morning.
You know? Yeah. It's like that. Their entire energy is Good Morning.
Yeah. Right. Stepping on a couch and like dancing like this.
And I think that is true. That is those three watching them on stage, listening to Jonathan Groff's speech. That is the shit that is going to turn a like middle schooler, high schooler into the next theater performer that we're standing. You know, they are watching that. They are like being moved by that and saying like, oh, this love of theater, this corniness, this fun shit that I love, singing Sondheim with my friends, that is what's going to make me want to pursue that as a career in New York.
Totally, totally. How did you feel about what kind of awards Stereophonic pulled then? I know you're a big Stereophonic stan.
I was very ecstatic for Stereophonic as well. You know, I like shout out to Juliana Canfield,
our girl,
for being part of this. Will Butler for, you know, from Arcade Fire, writing that amazing music. I have a couple friends who were producers on this. It's been nice to celebrate the show, and it's also been nice to have friends who are involved in the show and having seen it from, not from conception, but seeing it from last year when it was at Playwrights Horizon, you know, and it was just a buzzy show that some people were like, oh, this is really good. And some people were like, it's 3 hours long. And me being like, actually, I'm fucking obsessed with this show. And then it translating to Broadway and then seeing it again. That's just something I really enjoy about theater in and of itself, you know, as opposed to a film where, you know, you maybe see once and then you see it again. It's the same thing, but, you know, seeing people working on a project and, you know, seeing them on stage and seeing how their performances evolve from one theater to the next. It's really fun. It's just why I love theater. I'm so happy for Stereophonic and that a play is getting this much buzz, to be honest. And it's not one that's getting so much buzz because, like, I don't know, Julia Roberts is in it.
Yeah, right. No, it's just the material itself that's being highlighted. I also want to say something that's awesome about the Tonys is that there's this one layer of interest for people who live near or get to see a lot of Broadway, which is, like you said, you get to watch the evolution of certain projects. Maybe you saw an earlier version of it, and then you see this other, now it's being celebrated on stage and on TV in this way. And then for home viewers or like award show devotees, someone like me who, you know, obviously doesn't get to see all these plays, I think something that's awesome is you're not inundated with the award season campaigning. Not that I don't like that stuff and not that I'm not interested in it, but it's nice to sort of just drop in on a world, basically a subculture, and see what these people have been up to and sort of just root for, you know, productions based on what you think they are, or like the nobility of the projects, or maybe you've seen these actors in other things before. It's just kind of nice to see something where I'm like, I'm basing my guesses not on 80 precedents that have been set before us and the 80 award shows we've already watched.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Like, even I attended a like sort of for your consideration thing for Stereophonic, but it was really just performing some of the songs from the show.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't have the whole feel of the, you know, Oscar campaign season, which I'm sure it does if you're like entrenched in it, and I'm sure it's annoying, but, it is nice to just sort of drop in and see these shows. And I feel like there's so many shows, obviously, that I have never seen, that you remember their Tony performance, you know? And sort of like that is always going to stick with you for a show or get you interested in it. And I think that the one thing the Tonys do better than kind of the Oscars, to be honest, is the fact that you are really sort of advertising the show in a way that the movies don't, you know? You know, you are seeing it.
Right, yeah, especially nowadays, the Oscars, you might not even get clips of the movies anymore. One more thing I want to say about the Tonys. I was kind of blown away by the cheesiness of the Tommy performance. Like, you're telling me Pete Townsend's involved with this show? Like, this doesn't remind me of the rock album Tommy at all, or the movie Tommy, which has one of the craziest Best Actress nominations of all time, Anne Margaret. Watch that movie. Like, There is just not another slot in Oscar history that is like that. That's very unusual. But to say this performance of Pinball Wizard was gleeified is like understating the matter. It was just pure, like, Newsies energy ushering the songs of Tommy at you.
Yeah, I think the show is like truly bonkers and crazy and fun. So I'm all on board for it, but I can see how it does look a little goofy. I think once you're tapped in from the beginning of the show, I'm along for the ride.
Yeah. I mean, again, if you see the whole thing in sequence, yes, it's very surprising if you're a fan of that album. You know, it's a completely different vibe. You know, it's like you're hearing the Pitch Perfect cast is covering Tommy or something. I have no idea.
Well, on the flip side, my introduction to Tommy was Alex Newell performing it on Glee, the Pinball Wizard.
Oh, maybe that was what sparked this whole thing. If Alex Newell is involved, that is only a good thing.
Yeah, that's honestly one of my favorite performances of Pinball Wizard. So if you have not seen that, look it up on YouTube. Yeah, it's great.
And I will just say, to close this out, and in regards to Pride Month and Glee, please go and look up Gwyneth Paltrow's version of Party All the Time, which I am sorry to say has become one of my maybe top 20 Pride anthems.
Yeah, I mean, look at that up. And I think maybe I even brought this up last week, but like people who stopped watching Glee before they went to New York, like if you're missing out on Kate Hudson in Glee, like you really need to go and search for these clips, because the concept of Kate Hudson being a dance teacher, basically having beef with this 17, 18-year-old girl trying to fuck her boyfriend is truly wild. Great performance from Kate Hudson.
And also, we've just discovered recently that Kate Hudson, who now has new music out, is a fucking fabulous singer again. Now, I, of course, remember her in Nine being a wonderful singer, whatever. But she covered Voices Carried by Till Tuesday. And so she said, Lewis Faggot, this one's for you. And I was sitting upright and paying attention. It is an amazing cover. She did it for Howard Stern.
Yeah, she's a talent.
Yeah. She's just one of those people like Gwyneth Paltrow, you know, the Nepo thing where they did a lot early. And so I think after a while, they're just like, well, yeah, I already did it. Like, I'm not like restless to produce three movies a year or three projects a year or whatever. And so you get something from her when you get something for her. She has her Fabletics thing. And, you know, I like wearing, you know, a sexy black tight when I work out. So that speaks to me too.
Also, she's kind of a chill celebrity. I mean, chill in the sense that, every celebrity who lives in New York is somewhat chiller than like celebrities who live in LA, because you can be sitting in the West Village having brunch and just see her, you know, walking by with her kid or like with her husband or something. And there's just this sort of dissonance in celebrities who do that in New York, because they know that 98% of the time, like, no one's going to stop them.
Yeah, right. That says she really should do a project with Goldie at some point. I mean, TikTok. What are
we
doing?
I don't want to say we're running out of time here, you know, but like, honestly, her and Goldie and Kurt, like, let's get the whole family.
Yeah.
You know?
She's doing that podcast with her brother. Everyone's invited. Come on.
Yeah. I'm so excited for Death Becomes Her, by the way.
Oh, of course.
Which is coming to Broadway soon. That's something like that, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, Overboard, I have no idea. Lots of Goldie projects that could be mined here, I think. Private Benjamin should probably be a musical, honestly.
I feel like that's probably in the ether somewhere. The other thing about the Tonys, too, is that I just want to lastly say is that it's so interesting, like, knowing how, like, overstuffed the season is, and then knowing, like, so much other shit that's coming, too.
Yeah.
You know? Death Becomes Her, for instance. And then, like, even knowing shows that, especially musicals are workshopped outside of New York, like, often, like, in other cities. And, like, you know that they're coming. Like, we know that Vanessa Williams is going to be transferring from London in The Devil Wears Prada.
Right.
And then also, there is Titus
Burgess, yep.
Yes, is working with, I think, another Kimmy Schmidt writer on, there's a Preacher's Wife musical coming, and apparently it's very fucking good, you know? So it's stuff like that is fun to hear about. And I think one benefit that people who live in cities that aren't New York get is you get to see like a random show like that in Chicago, or like it's in Massachusetts or something, and then it'll be transferred to Broadway, you know, like in a couple years.
God, I hope Titus is the Preacher's Wife. I would love that. That is exactly right.
I also need to rewatch that movie, because I tried to explain the plot to someone and I realized I don't know how much I actually remember about The Preacher's Wife besides the music.
And also, I've seen the movie. It's based on The Bishop's Wife even more recently than I've seen that. So I probably need to be reacquainted.
I've never seen that.
Yep,
so.
From the 40s. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll watch both.
Great.
All right, when we're back, we're joined by Lily Gladstone.
The Sherwin-Williams Summer Sale is here. Get 30% off select paints and stains, or 35% off our newest product, Emerald Symmetry, July 17th through the 27th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Hi, everybody. It's James and Andy here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two-fourths of a group of people who love facts, and we love to find new facts, and we come here every week and tell each other about them. For instance, Andy, did you know that one of the world's oldest cycling road races is getting much harder because people keep stealing the road?
I want to know more already, but I'm instead going to tell you my new fact, which is that some ancient coffins from the 17th century have faces.
The coffins have faces.
It's really creepy.
Not just on the inside.
No.
Wow. If you like the sound of those facts, or indeed facts in general, then come and find us, No Such Thing as a Fish, wherever you get your podcasts.
The What a Day podcast you know and love is shaking things up. You already know that 5 days a week, I, Jane Coaston, bring you the need-to-know news and expert analysis on the big stories shaping today and tomorrow. Stories like how social media warps our perception of the world and the strange reality of who is signing up to work for ICE. All in less time than it takes to roast a chicken. And now, What a Day episodes will be hitting your YouTube and podcast feeds in the afternoons. You'll get the breaking news even faster. Check out What a Day, now dropping in the PM on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.
We are so honored to welcome this week's guest. She is a phenomenal talent known for her work in films like Certain Women and First Cow. And her name was the name of last year's award season after an unforgettable performance in Killers of the Flower Moon. Here to discuss her upcoming film, Fancy Dance, please welcome to Keep It, Lily Gladstone.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here.
Oh my God. It's like some people were excited to have, and then I'm actually like intimidated. Like you bring so much like gravitas when you enter any room, even though you have like such a great sense of humor too. I just like, some people just, they have a wise thing about them, and you are one of those people. So thanks for making this past award season so fabulous.
Oh, thank you so much. It's so sweet.
So your new movie, Fancy Dance. First of all, before you even get to the plot of this movie, it puts you in such a time and place that I feel like before even words are spoken, it is an unmistakable film. Talk about working with this director, Erica Tremblay, who has made short documentaries before this. But mm-hmm. I feel like this movie does so much to immerse the viewer. What do you think this movie does?
I mean, this movie does what I always hope art can do. And I felt that way the first time I got sent an Erica script. It was 2018. Got a text out of nowhere from Sterling Harjo, who I was friends with and had shot a pilot with. And he said, hey, I've got this mentee at Sundance that has a script she wants you to read. I said, great, send it over. And those 7 pages felt like an entire developed feature to me reading it. Every single beat in it was, there was nothing wasted, and all of it worked at a surface value for the scene. All of it was actionable. All of it was so minimal and not in your face, yet it spoke to just these huge societal issues. It did so effortlessly. I knew that this was an incredibly talented filmmaker, and I was so happy because I was like, oh, I found an indigenous Kelly Reichardt. And indeed, she watched Certain Women and just got so excited when she recognized indigeneity on screen. There's nothing in Certain Women that says my character's indigenous, but it lives there. And that just, Erica was so thrilled by that. So before we were even done shooting Little Chief, I was wanting to talk to her about if she had a feature in her. Because I know that's a leap. Like writing a short and doing it well is an incredible skill in a 7-page page count. I was curious how that would translate to a feature film. And Erica, before I could even ask her or talk to her about it, asked me if she could write something for me as a feature. And I was just, yes, on board 100%, and didn't know what that would be other than kind of the characters from Little Chief and what turned into Fancy Dance living in a similar realm, having a similar sort of vibe about them. But she knew that she wanted this character to also be queer. She knew that she wanted the film to have higher stakes than what the short did. The short is such a slice of life and gives you such a beautiful portrait of this world. But Fancy Dance was able to accomplish all of that, too. So when I finally did read the script, I was just blown away. It was one of those rare moments where you can read a feature script. You know, it's like it takes me a long time, a lot of times, to read features. Like, I stop and think and digest the scene that I just saw before continuing on, and then have to go reread it to pick up the flow, or I need to use the bathroom or whatever it is. Fancy Dance did in a feature what Little Chief did in 7 pages. It just clipped along, and I was there. I didn't look away from the page for a second. It felt like a 10-minute read, but it was, you know, clearly a 93-page script. And when I put it down, I was like, I checked in with my breath. I realized my face was covered in tears. I was just like, I'd had a real experience. And for the first time as an actor, one of the only times as an actor, I had read a script without projecting myself into it, without trying to imagine how am I going to play this? Like, how do I see myself in this character? I was just there with the character. And I didn't tell this to Erica until just a couple days ago, because never did I want her or Michiana and what they did, what they spun. That was so perfect and well-paced and just exactly like the short was, saying so much in such a minimal way that works at face value in the scene but has this huge allegory packed into it. I wasn't entirely sure that I was going to be able to do Jax justice. I didn't know that I was the right actor for her, but clearly Erica did. Jax didn't show up for me in a very real way that surprised me, and I was so relieved when the first lines were spoken and I heard Jax's voice, and I was like, oh, okay, there she is. She was there the whole time.
It's interesting to hear you speak about sort of projecting yourself into a work when you're reading a script. Obviously, you know, every script isn't going to have that indigeneity in the script, as you said. This one does. How do you, when you're reading something, whether it's a director you want to really work with or whether another actor signed on, where you're sort of, how do you find yourself able to project yourself into a work enough so that you're like, I can tackle this? And then how do you know when there's a piece where you're like, you know what, this actually isn't for me?
I think it's just, it's such a gut thing. You know, it's happened several times. I've been handed a script with where the creative has me in mind for a very specific role. And then when I'm reading it, I just keep resonating with another role in it. And sometimes it's a much smaller role, or sometimes it's a role that you wouldn't say is my type, but there's just something in it, something about the humanity or the way that they hang in a narrative that I'm just drawn to more, and I feel just a more natural flow with. And in that case, I usually just ask if I can read for the other character. and it's, you know, that's actually worked out really well in some cases. And it's redefined, you know, just work with friends, particularly plays when I was in college. But yeah, I think in the case of whatever I experienced in this relationship with Jax on the page, to Jax in action, Jax in the vans and doing the dancing and just, like, going through the motions, there's this sense, you know, I'll read a character and then immediately know how whoever has me in mind for that perceives me. And sometimes it's like, I get why, but no, there's actually nothing I can add to this or, you know, there's nothing that I want to explore in this. But in the case of Fancy Dance, Erica saw the world she wanted, and she knew that I was going to be the one that was going to execute it. I mean, the part was always written with me in mind. It was always written for me, and what she knows that I can do on screen and what I can do with her kind of work. So it really stood alone. I was really grateful to have that sort of out-of-body experience where a character really just shows up. And I think that must have something to do with lived experience, with subconscious experience, with the incredible talent and prowess of, like, the wardrobe department, of the production design that builds this world your character suddenly fits in. And then, of course, and remarkably, with an actor as deft and lived in and talented as Isabel. Isabel's Roki really created Jax for me. So, yeah, I don't know. The instinct when you see it on the page and what you're drawn to in certain characters, I think it's a gut thing. It has to do with where you're at that point in your life, with what you're trying to say in your work. Oftentimes, you know, especially if an Indigenous character is written to be Indigenous by a non-Indigenous writer, I can sometimes get a little resentful that I'm asked to read for those characters because there's not anything else in the element of that character that appeals to me other than the fact that they're a Native character and my name is doing stuff right now. It's a very gut level reaction to the story.
It was so evident as we read lots of interviews with you over the past year. Just you have an incredible sense of taste and also like a real droll sense of humor. I kept paying attention to like just what does Lily Gladstone like care about and watch? And two things stood out to me, and they were both in Kyle Buchanan's interview with you in the New York Times. One, you love Roseanne, and two, Kate Blanchett.
I wouldn't say I love Roseanne. I would say Roseanne is the first character I emulated on stage. It's the first way I was able to understand a character. So, and, you know, Roseanne was on as a kid, and I thought it was really funny.
Yeah.
It was something my parents liked watching. And she was a big character. So, yeah, my very first, like, character role that I took was an evil stepsister in Cinderella, and I chose to play that character like Roseanne.
Brilliant. Why hasn't this been done before? Yes.
We must see it again. But, yeah, Kate Blanchett, like, when I was starting to really zero in on, like, all right, acting is what I want to do, so I got to study actors. My mom said, like, let's watch this movie, Elizabeth. And I was just completely blown away by the transformation that she did. Like, I didn't know any of her other work before that, but the transformation she undergoes as, you know, young Elizabeth to the queen taking the throne at the end is just like the kind of physical journey that she went on, the gravity she has on screen, the way you just like lean in. As soon as Kate Blanchett pops up, you're just like, oh my God, and you're so there. And then I watched everything she did after that, and the diversity that she brings to all of her characters, yet they all feel so natural to her. I mean, I think the second actor that really grabbed me on screen, and the two that I say are kind of like the ones that mold and shape everything that I want to be and how I want to approach character, the other one is Philip Seymour Hoffman. Like the kind of characters that he would choose to play, the roles that he would take, the films that he would choose, his approach to acting, his relationship to storytelling. I still just go back to old interviews and watch his performances and just, I find myself in little funny ways. Just like when I do meet some of my idols, like I've met Kate Blanchett. She's been so supportive during this whole period of time. She was really pushing my performance in Killers of the Flower Moon through the campaign and doing just so much. She's so lovely. And it was like numbing. It was like a dream. It was like a numbing dream come true. And like I have these moments where I cross paths with people who worked with Philip Seymour Hoffman or who were close to him. And I just feel so much grief still. It's like that he has the same thing. Just that like gravity on screen and the way that he humanizes characters that are so complex that you're just hanging on. And the way he can also just do comedy. It's like people forget he was in Twister. He was my favorite part of Twister as a kid. So yeah, those two are kind of my idols.
When I think of you even bringing up, you know, acting out Roseanne in you know, the stepsister sort of role. I was thinking of this quote that Reese Witherspoon had recently, I believe, where it was, a lot of actors really do well because they think of an actor that they like and they really sort of try to emulate that person. Mm-hmm. And I feel like when you were first starting out, or even now, do you find that it's helpful to sort of think, well, how did this person do a role like this? And then maybe I can sort of use some of those tricks. Or do you now find yourself, I know who Lily is and what Lily sort of brings, and you can sort of tackle any sort of role.
I think as a younger actor, maybe I leaned on the emulation thing just to try it on, to kind of push myself outside of my own comfort zone. I think my undergraduate theater training really helped break me of that. And not that it's a bad thing, but I did find that when you emulate, it's so easy to slide into impersonate. And then are you really bringing anything unique and deep to the role? Or is it, I mean, when I would find myself doing that, even trying to, like, for example, like carry Kate's voice as Galadriel in Lord of the Rings into this other character, I'd find I was fixating on that more than what I was saying. It's like, and as soon as it becomes like, when I feel that little self-perception shift, it's like when you're in conversation with somebody and you know they're not listening to you anymore, it's like, you know, they're thinking about what they're going to say next. I found myself doing that with the characters. And it's like, you need to be so present and in the skin of the character that people, when they're saying something important, aren't really checking to see how they're saying it necessarily. You know, if it's coming from the heart, if it's immediate, if it's one of those dynamic moments, you just have to be in that character and in those given circumstances. So I think I kind of stopped doing that. And in undergraduate, I was given different tools that I do find myself leaning on, like animal study is a big one. Certain women, I was emulating a horse because who the rancher was spending all of their time, all of her time around for significant chunks. She was in isolation with horses. So like the kind of movement, like the shifting of weight, the physical language when you're around a horse, you need to be so tapped into because it's a big, kind, wonderful animal that could crush you. That could like be a very dangerous thing if they're not checking themselves. And there was like a piece in Miley Malloy's story about the rancher where who was originally a man in the treatment that I kind of hung on is like Chet got afraid of something in himself and thought it was best to not spend so much time alone. And I didn't ever try and define or judge what that would be in the rancher as I portrayed her, other than maybe sexuality. But I knew that I was playing somebody, and Kelly and I discussed this, that, you know, Kelly would talk about getting in writer's brain and being isolated, working on a script and not seeing many people for a couple of weeks. And then suddenly going to the bodega and like not knowing how to talk to a person. It's like not being the rancher's thing. So I relied on animal study for that character rather than thinking of another performance that I'd seen from another actor. You know, people are products of their environment, and not everybody's environment is sitting and watching film and absorbing performance. You know, if I play a character that's trying to break through and become an actor, sure, I'll do that. But it's all just kind of given circumstance and honoring the world and the worldview the character holds. And not every character wants to be an actor.
Before we let you go, my final question to you is, you have so many varied interests. Like, you've talked about, like, physics in certain interviews and, like, bees and stuff. Just, like, I love, like, people who just, like, can't stop having hobbies, basically. And it's just, do you have anything new you've taken on recently that you're learning everything about?
Soil acidity.
See? This is what I'm talking about.
I'm prepping a yard space for some flatbeds and deciding what kind of species of flowers I want to put in to feed the pollinators and just learning how to you know, have my pH over here for these sorts of things, my pH over here for these sorts of things, what's going to be good for the water. Just, yeah, that's kind of the interest right now.
Perfect answer. Thank you. Thank you.
Love that. Thank you so much for joining us today. I mean, it's really lovely to hear you speak about your work and just the care that you put into it. So
thank you both. Yeah. Thank you so much. I can feel that you do the same. It's nice to put your feet in a well-worn pair of shoes and just kind of talk. So thank you.
Oh my gosh, our pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
The What A Day podcast you know and love is shaking things up. You already know that 5 days a week, I, Jane Costin, bring you the need-to-know news and expert analysis on the big stories shaping today and tomorrow. Stories like how social media warps our perception of the world and the strange reality of who is signing up to work for ICE. All in less time than it takes to roast a chicken. And now, What A Day episodes will be hitting your YouTube and podcast feeds in the afternoons. You'll get the breaking news even faster. Check out What A Day, now dropping in the PM on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. The What A Day podcast you know and love is shaking things up. You already know that 5 days a week, I, Jane Costin, bring you the need-to-know news and expert analysis on the big stories shaping today and tomorrow. Stories like how social media warps our perception of the world and the strange reality of who is signing up to work for ICE. All in less time than it takes to roast a chicken. And now, What A Day episodes will be hitting your YouTube and podcast feeds in the afternoons. You'll get the breaking news even faster. Check out What A Day, now dropping in the PM on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, I am fully willing to retract some statements.
Oh, please.
To eat some crow here, because Normani's album, girl, this is the gag of the century.
I don't know how this happened. Why she kind of slow rolled us. And by the way, I mean the slowest.
She is the epitome of a friend who is arriving late to meet you at brunch, and it's, I'm 20 minutes away, I promise. Oh my God, there's traffic. I'm right around the block. I'm looking for parking. And then by the time you get to fucking brunch, it's like, we've already eaten. I guess we'll have a few more mimosas. And then that friend arrives, though, with like this interesting story, like some hot tea they're going to regale you with. And then you keep ordering more mimosas, and you're like, okay, you know what? Brunch is actually fucking fun. I've forgotten about, you know, the 2 hours I was waiting for your ass. And this album feels like that because it is good and enjoyable. And I want to tell you that being in Fire Island, of course, this weekend, as I said, there's nothing more fun than interacting with gays at a party where you're sort of like all coming to like the same conclusion about something. I mean, recently it's been like people discovering they like Chappelle Roan.
Right.
And now this time is people whispering, the album's kind of good, right? And everyone talking about songs they've been listening to. And I'm just, why was she sitting on this shit for so long?
It is weird. And she's obviously had some tribulations. Both her parents got sick, and that put her off of making new material for a while. But like, Normani's an interesting story. So she was obviously in Fifth Harmony. But Fifth Harmony's been over for a long time now. And then she was a part of two singles that are both, I would say, A's. You had Love Lies with Khalid, and then you had, I think, Sam Smith's best song, which Dancing with a Stranger.
Dancing with Strangers, that is such a fucking good song.
It's a good, sexy song for Sam Smith. Disco vibe, you know? And in the intervening time, she hasn't done much. There have been threats of a new album, obviously, and then they didn't have...
The threats.
Yeah, sorry. The Wicked Witch of the West. She's coming back with an album. No, right off the bat, I will say it's foolish to expect the sounds you would get on like a Fifth Harmony album or whatever, but like it's not a pop hooks album. This is largely an R&B album. But starting off, you do have the song Big Boy. That like hooks you in right away. Like there's like some momentum and sexuality to that.
That's a banger.
Take My Time is another disco sort of tinged song that again, it's not like an explosive disco song, but it has enough that you can sort of groove with that song.
That's from the Swedes. Like some Swedes did that shit, and that actually the same producers who did Dua Lipa and Calvin Harris's Electricity,
which I believe is a Grammy winning dance song. Candy Paint, which is her new single, I really love that too. I mean, I can't say, literally I think the end, Wild Side, which is a single she released before with Cardi B, feels a little bit weird at the end of the album. But there's also lots of stories. I think she spent a lot of time sequencing this album and picking what actually ended up on the album, and her perfectionism is evident. So I guess she's one of these people like, If you know who Lucinda Williams is, she'll take like 5 years to put out an album. And then every chord, every vocal is just absolutely immaculate. And I'm sure putting it together is, you know, a Stanley Kubrickian like experience where you were on take 127 and people are gouging their eyes out. But it sounds very smooth on the final product.
Yeah, I mean, side note, speaking of that, there's an interview in Billboard recently that my friend Stephen Horowitz did with Missy Elliott, who was going on tour this summer.
Oof.
And she's the same kind of person because Stephen was like asking her about music. And she's like, you know, like I probably have about 6 albums worth of music that I could release. But, you know, I'm just like, it's so interesting to me, an artist who like has amassed that much work. And it's just, where is the desire to be like, throw it out in the world? You know, but I guess once you do that, it's like it's permanent, you know?
That's true. No, I mean, like you and I are people who come from like the hell planet that is Twitter, where we just like say something, put it out, and we want an immediate response. There's like a dopamine quality to it. And these other people who are like artists, you know, like, I mean, think of the fucking Prince vault. I mean, what is still in there? Mounds and music videos are in there that nobody has seen before. Like people actually just care about, yeah, what actually gets on the Wikipedia discography? What's actually, you know, in the list of canon content?
I feel like we are always brainstorming a gay Ocean's 11 on this show. And where is the Oceans about breaking into the Prince vault? I need the Vanity 6 songs. I need the videos. I want Carmen Electra's album, okay?
Oh, my God. No, please. Oh, we could go through all the mentees who have no material that came out or whatever. Yeah, Apollonia, etc. Yeah, I know there's more where that came from.
Well, another real good highlight of this album is, I guess, the songwriters and the people she works with. She works with Victoria Monet on this album. I think that's very evident. Especially in a song like, Insomnia,
great song.
Which is, yeah, you know, that's also a song with Brandy, like there's Brandy vocals in it too. The collaborators on this, it just feels so meticulous and like the vocals on it are so great. Normani's always been an exciting talent to watch, and you can understand why other people in the industry like her because she can sing. She can dance, and everyone's just sort of rooting for her, you know? And I think it's interesting in the context of Camila Cabello, whose album comes out next week.
It doesn't end, yes.
Yeah, you know, just seeing like how much shit she's put out since, and then remembering their whole story from Fifth Harmony and like the sort of rift they had because of, you know, Camila's old racist tweets resurfacing from when she was a kid and her like taking forever to apologize for it. So, you know, like they've been on these separate journeys, but I just feel like it's nice to have this music out in the ether now. It's nice to sort of see like, okay, this is a product I can support. And I almost feel like I'm gonna be forgiving a bit because the album is from RCA and a notoriously messy record label. I mean, if you think about Tinashe right now, right, who's having like such a big moment with Nasty, and you think about how many amazing songs she's had before, like Super Love, for instance, that should have been hits. What was the common denominator there? It was RCA. Mm. And after leaving RCA, now she's having the success. And I believe Tinashe even just had an interview where she was like, well, I know those executives over at RCA are gagging about this.
Did we talk about this a little bit last week? I was surprised to reacquaint myself with the fact that Normani basically does not like the song Motivation, which was not a huge hit. Like, it did crack the top 40, but that was sort of a rallying around her moment that happened, at least with our people. I'm talking about fags. But I do feel like it's always interesting. Like, it reminds me of that Cher interview I always bring up where she says, I'm not a Cher fan. Because I feel like a lot of the time, the women who make pop music, I'm not saying it's not for them, but I guess it's somewhat unusual or more unusual that like a woman's favorite type of music would be like power pop, I guess, as opposed, since it's such gay guy culture. I don't know. But I was surprised to hear that because I think Motivation is just an immediate like, oh, pick me up song. Like, of course, play that song, you know?
Yeah, but of course, now listening to Dopamine, if you can understand that this is the kind of music that she wanted to be making, you know, Victoria Monet style music, like working with Brandy, if your label is like, we're going to make a pop album produced by Max Martin, why you would maybe be upset with that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it feels like you had no hand in it whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. That's just all to say that this is a good album. And I'm hoping for like videos,
yeah,
you know, or like some live performances, some promotion. Because I feel like even leading up to this album, like, girl, were you running out of minutes on your phone or something? Like, could we get a single tweet or
yeah,
something
right,
like that? Like, either album kind of just arrived with no fanfare.
No, that is weird. And again, we are like awash in fanfare of all these other albums. Like the lead up to Dua Lipa's album or a Billie Eilish album was like so extreme, you know?
Yeah. Honestly, if we're talking about promotion and rollout, I want to commend Charlie XCX, who got number 2 on the UK album charts, thanks to a sinister woman who got number 1.
Right.
She who shall not be named.
Yes. She's 8 weeks at number 1. Yes.
Yeah. We don't want to name her lest this video references Taylor again on YouTube.
And it's like, Louis Pertell says Taylor Swift should die in the following ways.
Yeah. And she debuted at number 3 on the US chart, selling like more than double what Crash, Charlie's previous album, had sold. And I just want to attribute that to the rollout for the album Brat, which felt very big, but not so big when you think about the ways that music used to be promoted when we were, you know, younger, like TRL,
yeah,
right? Like Charlie's album rollout felt so much like, I don't know, Britney or Christina or Destiny's Child promoting an album in the TRL era. Like they would be everywhere. There would be sponsorships. There would be performances. They'd be showing up next to Carson Daly being like, hey kids, have you heard like the new single? You know, it's actual promotion, which felt so shocking coming from Charlie because we've just been in this era of Beyonce gives you Cowboy Carter and then bye, she's mysteriously driving a truck around the country. I don't know, murdering people. and Miley Cyrus gives you an album and then it's peace out,
right,
no tour. I mean, Taylor gives you the album and she's pretty much the only one doing something with her album. But even that isn't traditional promotion in the sense that is, if you want to hear these songs, come to my tour where I'm singing these songs every night now, but you're not going to see me perform them live or do anything else. Like you got to pay me,
mm-hmm,
you got to pay to play.
It also must be said, I mean, people are just, it's like Charlie XCX became everybody's favorite. Like I saw footage of her performing in LA over the weekend and the crowd went back and back and back. And it did not look like there was one inanimate body in that crowd. People have just like, it's like there's this accumulating sense of ownership over her. And now she's having this sort of crowning moment and everybody's a part of it. No, I mean, it's amazing what's happened to her in the past 6 months alone, let alone the past 3 years.
Amazing that, to see the same rise happening with Tinashe, because I feel like they're both artists who started, I mean, they have that song Drop That Kitty, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
And they both are artists that started what, like a decade ago-ish? And we have been gays who've seen them performing at our pride festivals or, you know, like 7-Eleven parking lots with Bonnie, yep, McKee. And now they are actually like getting sort of like the flowers they deserve. Like they're being respected as artists. And it's, I don't know, this interesting thing in pop music right now. I mean, you can almost attribute it to like the Chappell Roan of it all too, you know, like how much like these two songs, it's been so crazy in real time to see how her crowds have grown at each concert to where they're massive, to the point where she was on stage in a recent video where she was choked up just saying like, I'm sorry guys, I need a moment. Like this is all just happening so fast for me.
Yeah, and you could see why. It's like a completely different vibe. It reminds me in a way of in the mid-90s when, before Jagged Little Pill came out, mm-hmm, Alanis Morissette started performing at like small clubs or whatever, and suddenly like overnight people are screaming You Ought to Know back at her, and it's like that's a there's nothing can prepare you for that. So like you go from being somebody some people may have heard of to you are anthemic and important to people. And that is, I imagine, very shocking.
Yeah, I mean, I believe Chappell was like, what, like a camp counselor or something, like a year ago last summer, you know? And that's just to say that I feel like we're in such an interesting era for pop music right now, where, yes, there are the sales and like the internet fandom things that matter, but people seem to be showing up in a real way IRL for live music again.
And by the way, IRL music is also expensive. So these people like tend to make a lot of money. Like I was watching the resale Charlie tickets and it was like getting up to $400. I'm like, shit, I didn't pay that much to go to a family funeral.
And the IRL thing is interesting too, because I feel like we always bring up the fact that when you used to like your favorite artists, like Madonna, Mariah Carey, you know, Michael Jackson, you had to physically go out and buy their albums.
Right.
One. And if you wanted to see them in concert, you had to fucking line up outside of the box office to buy tickets. There was none of this like online, like waiting for a queue and like your Ticketmaster crashing or something. It's like, you remember just seeing like old news clips or MTV or something where they'd be interviewing fans who are like sleeping over, camping out at night to get Madonna tickets.
Oh yeah. I would line up at Tower Records to get autographs from people. Remember autographs? Are we fucking done with that?
Charlie was doing autographs.
What an insane idea.
Like stores.
Definitely write your name with this marker on my thing so that I can have it. What is it? Like that's so primitive. It's so caveman. In the age of selfies, it feels just utterly irrelevant.
I know. I saw her doing that with people, like doing actual album signings. And I don't think the last album signing I went to was like for Garbage, maybe like 5 years ago or something. But I don't know, bringing back that old era of just personalization with your fans, but not just online anymore. Like giving them actual things to show up for, I think is going to be really sort of what saves pop music in the industry and gets younger people involved in wanting to stan their artists. And I would love people to be standing their artists in public instead of online and threatening to murder you.
Yeah. Though, you know what else is going to save pop? Katy Perry's weird new single, which...
Girl, I mean, we can talk about it.
There's a snippet of it. And now, I have a question. Dr. Luke is allegedly involved in this album. Does he do all the songs, including this one? Because I thought the whole thing with Dr. Luke was, if you sold your soul to get Dr. Luke involved, the music would be good. Because this... It's like, I'm fine with like auto-tuney, soundy vocals, but like there's something kind of warped about how she sounds. Like the lyrics feel a little bit 15 years ago in a way.
I mean,
it's weird.
Calling the song A Woman's World in the first place is very Martha and the Vandellas. So,
there literally is a Cher song called A Woman's World. Yeah, from like 2011 or so.
Tell the truth.
Yeah, I love that
fucking
song.
This is A Woman's World.
Yeah.
And this song, someone, I think there was some tweet about it, how it sounds like a RuPaul song.
Yeah, which, by the way, that's not always a bad thing. I can get into that.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
I mean, if this were Hustle That Cat.
Oh, please.
Sure.
Pink Limousine off the last album, love it.
So the album was, I guess, an Ava Max song, an Ava Max scrap. And the Dr. Luke work is some reworking of the chorus and like some other lyrics and stuff. So she went to the doctor and didn't even get like a prescription. She went to the doctor and got cosmetic work done. Like this was operation. And it feels like the tweezers hit something and you know, you got that buzzing sound that happens in the game.
Water on the knee. Yeah.
Yes. And what's extra funny about this Katy Perry thing is the visuals have been like so cunt. Like, honestly, like she looks great.
She looks like an American Gladiator. If an American Gladiator were Michelle Visage, that's what she looks like.
Yes. And just the whiplash from these amazing visuals to the snippet that she posted. We're like, ooh, girl, the song is coming out July 11th. So you got some time to get back in the studio if you'd like to.
Right.
Just work back from the title.
Right. That's right. That's right. Also, it's the 4th. So, like, you know, the studio won't be booked. You can take it. Yeah.
But, yeah, I haven't seen that much goodwill for an era dissipate so quickly by hearing the snippet, because people were actually so excited for a Katy Perry comeback, which was shocking.
Yeah, right. No, I mean, and also again, this Normani album is great. There's an opportunity here for it to be great. And also, again, maybe the chorus is a banger. We didn't hear anything from the chorus, so who knows?
Yes, there was a leak of the alleged song, but our friend Ty Sunderland assures me that he has heard part of the chorus and that that is not the thing that is circulating online. So it seems like someone attached an AI own version to the snippet and acted as if they were a leak, which is, I guess, shit that bored people do on the internet.
Oh my God. Don't funk with my heart, quoth Fergie.
Where's she at?
Great question. She took that MILF money and said, I'm choosing obscurity.
That's when I know pop music will be saved again, when she is doing acrobatics on stage.
Yes. Pop stars, if I can recommend one thing to you before we move on, round offs. I mean, it's just something you can learn.
All right, when we're back, keep it. And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It. Lewis?
Oh, yes. Sometimes when I hear a snippet about a celebrity, it's just I don't want to know. Even if it, I think, is ultimately beneficial or there's like comedy value to it. This is one of those cases. There's a new book called Apprentice in Wonderland about former President Donald Trump. And in the book, it details Trump's obsessive crush on Deborah Messing. I don't want to know. I can't hear that. I don't know how this happened. I don't want to know the details. I don't want to hear her tweets in response, because she's going to have, I'm going to guess, roughly in the 50 to 75 tweets range response to this. Yeah. I, too, have enjoyed Deborah Messing over the years. As you know, she was in the workshop of Angels in America before it became a huge sensation. So there's some credibility there. Will and Grace, a wonderful TV show. She was in that weird movie where she played the police detective who's investigating the disappearance of somebody's kid.
Yeah, that Deborah Messing movie is Searching, with John Cho is in that. And that is also from the creators of Missing, a very iconic film with Storm Reid and Nia Long. If you have not seen it, like, it's actually one of my favorite movies of last year. Well, then there's also The Mysteries of Laura.
Oh, yes. And we didn't solve one of those out of disinterest.
The mystery was how it got made.
Right. And it got multiple seasons, I believe, too. That was a bit troubling. Ned and Stacey, a lovely show with Thomas Hayden Church. Smash. A great show which had two good songs. But otherwise, I do not want to think about this man having a crush, period. Let alone on Deborah Messing, who is, I think, maybe the most skittish celebrity of all time. I can't picture them together. That's all I have to say about that. Okay. I can't even say it doesn't sit well with me, because I won't let it sit. I'm pushing it off my chest like a sleep demon.
Yeah. So weird, too, because she hates that man.
Hates him the most. I mean, she's one of those, like, you know, Patricia Arquette people who's, like, retweeting, like, 100,000 news links about a bad thing he did. Not that they shouldn't do that. It's just a particular kind of Twitter behavior.
Well, you know what? I thought of one other thing. Her appearance in Bros. Very funny.
Very funny. Also, her appearance on Billy on the Street. Sensational.
Yeah.
Where Billy walks around yelling, "Listen, you gays, it's Deborah Messing." And then people scream.
Honestly, Deborah Messing, a celebrity that I feel like we would all love if Twitter had never been existed.
Right. No, she's kind of like, I mean, this seems so obvious. She comes from the sitcom world, like a Jennifer Aniston. Just like the entire personality is right there on the screen. I'm ready for a one-liner. I have a relatable sort of neurosis about me. Let's make this episode work thing.
Speaking of Deborah Messing, my Keep It is related to someone else from Will and Grace.
No, it's not. Hold on. Who could it be? I'm thinking, is it Miss Mullally?
It is. It is not anything that Mullally has done herself. We love Mullally. We love Nick Offerman. America's Sweethearts.
Yes.
I am talking about whoever is responsible for the poster for this film, The Fabulous Four, starring Megan Mullally, Bette Midler, Susan Sarandon, and Cheryl Lee Ralph. Have you seen this?
Yeah, I just saw it, I believe, on your account. Now, first of all, we get like five of these types of movies a year now where it's like, you know, Diane Keaton, Sally Field, Jane Fonda. It's just like Jane Curtin may sneak in there. Like these, like, and by the way, we want them. And it looks like they cost about a nickel to make, and that's fine. And I'll see it in the month of exactly April.
This movie is called The Fabulous Four, and the tagline says four friends, one wedding, lots of baggage. The poster for this, first of all, I said it looks like something my grandmother had on VHS in 1994,
which should be its own Criterion collection. I mean to say that.
Yeah. First of all, you have Bette Midler in the background of the, like, the four women are superimposed onto this poster, which shows the like beach and palm trees beneath them. Very sunset beach vibes here. But Bette Midler is in sort of a wedding dress and veil and only doing what I can only describe as raising the roof.
You know, that was a silly take and they said, we're going to go with it.
Do a fun one. Shirley Ralph looks like she is posing at the mall for photos.
She's a realtor who is going to take her time with you.
Meanwhile, Susan Sarandon looks like a school teacher who was just like snapped by the yearbook, like caught off guard. She's wearing glasses. She has a satchel over her.
Her mane is very like 70s male heartthrob too. Like Leif Garrett or something. Yeah.
And then Megan Mullally is holding the bouquet of flowers, like with one arm up in the air, like shouting, this photo of Megan Mullally, who is this woman?
She does look to be 28 years old. She does look to be 28 years old.
She looks airbrushed to hell. People have been like, is this Kacey Musgraves? Is this young Lana Del Rey? It is. It looks nothing like Megan Mullally.
It reminds me of that, I think it's Sex in the City 2. That's the one where they do I Am Woman, right? Yes. Where there's that, there was a publicity still of Kim Cattrall in one photo where it was just, this woman is 11 years old. How? What happened?
So, yeah, this poster is crazy. Also, yes, we do get a bunch of these movies. And while they are fun, it's a novelty for, you know, gays of a certain age.
Yes.
And I guess the women who go to see them. Can we start putting these women in other movies, though?
Right. I feel like Alfre Woodard was in one of these recently. And I'm like,
yes,
you can't be nominated for 18 Emmys and then we have to do this now. As much as you want to work with Kathy Bates or whoever's in this movie. It does feel like we can elevate it somehow, like one step. Like, can it be about like a grisly murder too or something? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, we even did this to Angela Bassett once. She was in that movie Otherhood with Patricia Arquette, Felicity Huffman.
I don't even know this one.
Yeah, you're gathering these older women and giving them roles, but can it be a murder mystery? Like, can we have someone make it a raunchy comedy or something? Like, The Fabulous Four. Boys on the Side without the murder?
Yeah. Boys on the Side is a movie people should bring up more often, by the way. I enjoy Boys on the Side.
Great movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's it.
Yeah. No, I think that was important that you brought that to everybody's attention. I can't believe we slayed half the cast of Will and Grace. We did not plan that. Should I come after Sean Hayes and Goodnight Oscar last Tony season? No, he was great, actually. I have no complaints.
Didn't Eric McCormick do something recently that was annoying?
The last time I saw him was on The Other Black Girl, in which he was good.
Eric McCormick defends straight actors playing gay characters. Playing gay characters is part of the gig. Honestly, he's right. Otherwise, we'd never see a single Paul Mescal movie.
That's exactly right. And also, Eric McCormick, of course, Emmy-winning turn as a gay man, and I bought every single second of it.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you to Lily Gladstone for joining us. Fancy Dance will debut in select theaters on June 21st, this week, before streaming globally on Apple TV Plus on June 28th. Yeah, that's our show.
Take that, faggots. Straight people win. There are gods. We'll see you next week.
Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok.
You can also subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our producers are CJ Siege Pokinghorn and Chris Lord. And our associate producer is Kennedy Hill. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, Louis Vertel, and Kendra James.
Our digital team is Megan Patzel, Claudia Shang, and Rachel Gajewski. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to Matt DeGroat, David Tolles, Kyle Seglin, and Charlotte Landis for production support every week.
The What A Day podcast you know and love is shaking things up. You already know that 5 days a week, I, Jane Costin, bring you the need-to-know news and expert analysis on the big stories shaping today and tomorrow. Stories like how social media warps our perception of the world and the strange reality of who is signing up to work for ICE. All in less time than it takes to roast a chicken. And now, What A Day episodes will be hitting your YouTube and podcast feeds in the afternoons. You'll get the breaking news even faster. Check out What A Day, now dropping in the PM on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.